Good mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, it's the economy, stupid. How many times have we heard that? And many voters cited economic concerns as the key issue that swayed their decision in the presidential election. So will Donald Trump be able to deliver the relief that Americans are hoping for? Also this morning, Monday is Veterans Day. And with the holidays coming up, the Library of Congress wants to make this the season to preserve the firsthand history of those who have served. We'll explain. In our high school football preview, Macomb head coach Chris Algie previews the Panthers' regional quarterfinal at Mohawk. And we have another collection of yummy and easy-to-make recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Friday, November 8th. 2024. Did you hear there was an earthquake in Ohio? Yeah, the U.S. Geological Survey confirmed that there was an earthquake yesterday morning along the Ohio-Kentucky border. An earthquake along the Ohio River. I don't think that they issued any tsunami warnings. It's right there along the river, so you see. It actually was just a magnitude of 2.4, happened a few minutes after midnight, just southeast of Georgetown in Brown County, Ohio. They do say that earthquakes at that magnitude of 2.4 are not normally felt by humans, so most people just slept right through it, as it turns out, but an earthquake in Ohio is not completely unheard of. I once actually was in an earthquake in Ohio. This is years and years ago, and I was at work at the radio station that I worked for at the time. I was actually on the air when the earthquake struck, although I was not speaking on the air at the time. I was working for a music station. We were in the middle of a music set. And suddenly everything started shaking in the building. And I said later, it was a good thing that I was not actually on the air speaking at the time, because there were some things that came out of my mouth, words that came out of my mouth that you wouldn't have wanted on the air. So all of a sudden the phones lit up and people were like, was that an earthquake? What did we just feel? Yeah, it is crazy. But an earthquake in Ohio yesterday. Big story there that we all missed. So in the aftermath of the election, this is actually rather disturbing. Authorities are now investigating some racist text messages, which are allegedly being sent to African Americans around the country. The text message says, in part, congratulations, you have been selected to pick cotton at the nearest plantation. Goes on to say that the recipient of the message will soon be picked up by a white van, and it says it is then signed a Trump supporter. That's what the text message. Now, who's sending these? No one knows, but the messages have been reported to be received around the country, including in Ohio, in Michigan, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, and elsewhere. Yesterday, the FBI released a statement saying that it is aware of the racist texts and is in contact with the Justice Department and other federal authorities. Hopefully they can track down who in the world is responsible for this and hold them accountable appropriately. That's just terrible. That is just terrible. I mean, come on, people. Can we stop? Please? Can we stop with this? Wow. This is not the kind of story that you want to wake up to post-election. Let's see. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. On a lighter note, we now have a list, because I know everybody was waiting for this, a list of the most popular names given to dogs in the state of Ohio. The most the most popular dog names list. We'll come up with a list for anything. You know, we will come up with a list for anything. The names were ranked by U.S. News and World Report, because it must have been a very slow news day. After the election, they must have had absolutely nothing to report, U.S. News and World Report. So they are out with the list of the most popular dog names broken down state by state. They looked at pet insurance companies to determine which names were the most popular in each state and nationally. So somebody did some serious research on this. The crack news team at U.S. News and World Report was like, we're on it. And just see the pitch meeting. They're all sitting around a table pitching stories, and somebody comes up with this one and says, we're on it, boss. In order, 1 through 5, the most popular dog names in Ohio the past year were Bella, Luna, Daisy, Buddy, and Max. Not a whole lot of creativity there, I have to say. Bella, by the way, took the top spot nationally. So now you know. Now you know all of the important stuff. The most important story of the week. Outside of maybe the election. Here's another big story. Holiday season right around the corner, and the Rockefeller Christmas tree is on its way to New York City. The 74-foot-tall Norway spruce was cut down yesterday morning in West Stockbridge, Massachusetts. It is in the middle of a 140-mile trek to Rockefeller Center, set to arrive tomorrow morning. It will then be spruced up with 5 miles of LED lights and topped with a 9-foot, 900-pound Swarovski star. The tree lighting ceremony is set for December 4th. It will be broadcast on NBC because NBC is right there at 30 Rock. So they are the network of choice for the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. And the tree itself will be on display until, I think, mid-January. So plan to visit the Big Apple and see the Rockefeller tree. 74 feet tall, 5 miles of LED lights. That is incredible. And lastly, here among the first things that you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, further proof that I have just become too obsessed with social media. This, to me, is further proof that we are just too obsessed with internet fame. Danielle Bonadonna, or Bonadonna, I don't know how you pronounce it, B-O-N-A-D-O-N-A, Bonadonna, Bonadonna, anyway. This person, Danielle, whatever her name is a TikToker who apparently has achieved some measure of fame. I am not familiar, but I'm not on TikTok. So if you are, maybe you know who this is. So anyway, she's getting married, but she does not want to part with her maiden name. However, she is also not sure if she wants to hyphenate her maiden name with her married name. And so she is asking the rest of the world. She is leaving it up to her wedding guests and all of social media, apparently. There are two options. Both bride and groom hyphenate their last names to create Bonadonna Bartlebaugh. Or each partner keeps their name as is. Neither of us want to give up our last name, and so we're just going to have our guests and our fans vote on it. Danielle says, I've been called Bonadonna my whole life, and so that's the name I go by. She doesn't go by her first name, apparently. So maybe she could drop her first name. I don't know. The wedding is scheduled for February of next year, and the dilemma apparently has inspired songs and even a dance trend on social media. Can we all agree that we have reached critical mass on this social media nonsense? That we have turned over too much of our lives to social media when we allow our quote-unquote fans to decide what our name will be? I don't know. Just, I don't get it. But then again, it's maybe what it is not so much an indictment on social media. Maybe it's more an indictment on me as a cranky old guy now. Maybe that's I have officially crossed the threshold to being a cranky old fuddy-duddy because I don't get it. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your TGI Friday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Plenty of sunshine expected today with a high around 60. Just a few clouds tonight, a low around 40. A majority of voters in the Findlay City School District rejected the school district's bid to pass a 1% earned income tax levy on Election Day. The Board of Education previously said if the levy were to fail, cost-cutting measures would have to be taken. Superintendent Dr. Andy Hatton on with WFIN's Chris Oakes.
The first round of potential or likely cuts, financial adjustments that might need to be taken up by the Board of Education would be right around $5 million starting next year.
He said the Board of Education will have to decide whether to put a levy back on the ballot next year as the district is facing a looming deficit. You can hear Chris's full interview with Dr. Hatton about how the district will proceed after the levy failure in this story on our website. The Findlay Police Department recently received recertification from the Ohio Collaborative Community Police Advisory Board. The collaborative was formed in 2015 to create uniform standards for law enforcement agencies in Ohio. Agencies completing the recertification process adopted and implemented the initial two standards regarding use of force and hiring and recruitment. Give more details on the certification process in this story on our website. Ohio U.S. Senator-elect Bernie Moreno offered some clarity on some of his positions after defeating incumbent Sherrod Brown.
Bernie Moreno's campaign leaned heavily on reducing inflation, slowing immigration, and cutting crime by supporting police. He also told supporters he plans to cut government spending and give more power to teachers.
On the environment, Moreno says he'll end electric vehicle mandates and favors an energy policy that relies on oil, gas, coal, and nuclear power.
ONN's Kevin Landers reporting. The high school football playoffs continue tonight with a trio of games on your local radio stations. 10-1 Liberty Benton will play at 11-0 Liberty Center on WFIN. Ottawa Glandorf will play at Shelby on 106.3 The Fox. And Macomb will take on Sycamore Mohawk on 100.5 WKXA. All games are set to kick off at 7 o'clock tonight. Remember, you can always get more news online at WFIN.com.
Well, you know, it was political operative James Carville who coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid," back in 1992 in describing the successful strategy of Bill Clinton to win the presidency. And in 2024, it turns out it still is. Many voters cited economic concerns as the key issue that swayed their vote. So, will Donald Trump be able to deliver the relief that Americans are hoping for? Bankrate senior economic analyst and Washington Bureau chief Mark Hamrick is with us now. And first off, Mark, I guess you could say that he's going to have something of a head start on that because the Federal Reserve just lowered interest rates again.
Yeah, good to be with you, Chris. That was, of course, fully expected. And now we've gotten 0.75% reduction in the Federal Reserve's benchmark rate. And the outlook is further rate cuts. But I would also note that, you know, this was the response to historically high inflation.
Right.
And Americans' wants on the economic checklist are pretty more substantial than that. And so he's going to have his work cut out for him.
Yeah. You mentioned that this 0.25% rate cut that was announced this week was expected. The 0.5% cut back in September was a little bit of a surprise. Now the expectation is another 0.25% in December and more cuts in 2025. Of course, nothing is set in stone. What could happen that would change that outlook?
Well, the first thing would be in terms of requiring, let's say, a slower path or no further rate cuts would be a flare up of inflation, which would always necessitate some kind of response in the sense of interest rates. And of course, a more aggressive rate cutting path would follow if the economy were seen slowing sharply. That would include if the unemployment rate were to rise sharply.
So, as you mentioned, the rate cut didn't really have anything to do with the presidential election. It was a coincidental timing. It does kind of play into Donald Trump's favor, but it was kind of interesting, and this kind of touches on what you were saying earlier. During the campaign, I saw a lot of memes on social media. I think we all did, comparing the price of everything during the previous Trump administration to their corresponding prices now. And I would see those and think to myself, we're kidding ourselves if we think things are going to go back to the way they were. Or are we? I mean, what impact does a president's policies have on those things that Americans care about?
Yeah, I think that this is widely misunderstood, leaving aside, you know, the reasons why the American public, at least in the form of the popular vote and the Electoral College, decided that President Trump should be the next president again. And what I mean by that is there's not a lever in the Oval Office for the president to pull to stop inflation. If there were, probably Joe Biden would have pulled it.
Right.
And that is why you have the Federal Reserve that governs monetary policy, with interest rates being the principal tool. You know, the primary causes of inflation as we have known it were essentially threefold. Number one was the supply chain disruptions caused by the pandemic and the strong demand on the part of consumers that followed. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which caused a spike in the global prices of commodities, including food and energy. And thirdly, strong fiscal measures, by the way, taken under both administrations, aimed at providing the economy forward momentum. So those were all unique factors. That is not to say that that the Biden administration and Vice President Harris couldn't have done a better job addressing those issues or enunciated a better path forward. But I think the president's power on this front is widely overestimated. But you know what? Both candidates promised that they would bring down prices. I listen to all that and say, good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what I'm thinking, too. I mean, you know, obviously there are a lot of factors at play. As you mentioned, presidential policies are just one of them. And is it even, you know, the biggest one? I mean, how, to what extent is the president just kind of along for the ride like the rest of us?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, we remember the saying that was made popular, I believe, during the Truman administration. So perhaps a few, if any, of your listeners familiar with that. But the notion was the buck stops here, meaning
right.
Americans tend to ascribe blame or credit for some sort of achievements, particularly with respect to the economy. But I do think the presidents can do harm. They can do that by, in the current environment, adding to the federal debt and deficits or backing and or proposing legislation that would add further, more substantial inflation-causing dynamics within the economy. And that is an actual risk of the Trump administration.
Well, and that is a point that I wanted to, you know, kind of examine as well, because to the extent that the president's policies does impact the direction or the temperature of the economy, a big part of the degree to which Donald Trump's policies will impact the direction of the economy lies in the fact that Republicans will also be in control of Congress as well. So essentially no roadblocks to that economic agenda, but also no safety net either. Nothing to guard against unintended consequences from any of those policies.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Federal Reserve will do what it needs to do if it sees things, for lack of a better way of putting it, going out of control. And you're right. It does look as if the GOP will control the House of Representatives, although that is not yet written in stone, but it does appear obviously that that there's a very good chance of that. And so the question is, do Americans prefer some degree of divided government, or in this case, are they looking for a Hail Mary pass on some of these key issues? I wanted to mention, Chris, that before the election day, we did have a survey of Bankrate about the main economic issues, and perhaps no surprise, number one was inflation. Mm-hmm. But after that was healthcare costs, and number three was affordable housing. These are essentially on the checklist of things that Americans want to have addressed by elected officials. And so we'll be watching to see how those are addressed, if they are.
Well, and that's another one of the things that you've been quick to point out, that we don't really even know how the incoming administration will deal with those issues and even the more serious long-term fiscal challenges like the massive federal debt deficits, looming funding shortfall for Social Security, because no one really talked about that in substantive terms. This was very much a soundbite campaign, and I suppose that always happens. But you know, we really don't have a whole lot of details here.
No, I think the rhetoric on both sides was a lot of telling people what they want to hear and telling people why the other person was less than optimal. And that left a big void with respect to these policy specifics, specifically on the question of Social Security. And much the same as both candidates saying the inflation problem, I will fix it. Both candidates have essentially said in so many words, we promise you'll get your Social Security benefits. But the problem is that the looming shortfall that you mentioned earlier requires that within a decade, there will be a rather significant cutback in those payouts by law. And so the longer we wait to address the Social Security issue, the fewer avenues are available to sort of make the math work without causing, let's say, more dire solutions.
Well, it's not like government ever kicks the can down the road or anything like that, he says. He says with his tongue planted firmly in his cheek. Yeah. So it'll be very interesting to see where those actual policies or how those actual policies flesh themselves out moving forward. Again, Bankrate senior economic analyst and Washington Bureau chief Mark Hamrick with us this morning talking about the impact to which a president can actually impact the direction of the economy, especially on some of these issues that voters say they care most about. Mark, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Chris. We're going to have a lot to talk about in the months and year ahead. Thanks so much.
So this coming Monday is Veterans Day, and with that, and the fact that the holidays are right around the corner, the Library of Congress wants to make this the season to preserve history. So what do we mean by that? Well, the Veterans History Project is encouraging people as families are getting together over the next couple of months to record their conversations and their interviews with veterans among their loved ones to document their personal stories. Monica Mahindra is director of the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress with us this morning. And I know, Monica, we have talked about this before, but for the benefit of those who don't know, what is the Veterans History Project? And kind of expand on that question of why this emphasis on engaging volunteers and veterans in this project now, this season.
Well, it's really a multitude of things. The Veterans History Project, though, first and foremost, is your listeners' opportunity to participate, engage with, and encounter history. And by that, I mean it is designed by Congress for individuals across the country to interview and gather the first-person narrative of the veterans in their lives, in their communities, those who served the U.S. veterans who served from World War I through the more recent conflicts. When you use those archival principles that we offer through our practice and on our website, you then become part of what is the other part of the Veterans History Project, which it is a huge national collective archive of first-person remembrances, 120,000 voices strong and growing by your addition to it. And why now? Well, we're headed into Veterans Day. We're headed into the holiday season. We think of Veterans Day as the kickoff for Veterans Season because it's such a great opportunity for anyone to become a volunteer, to reach out to the veteran in their life and ask them with the seriousness of purpose of taking some time over the holidays to sit down and gather their story to ensure that it's part of this national collective effort at our nation's library.
And as director of this project, nobody knows better than you the impact of this and literally tens of thousands, more than 100,000 stories that makes this project so special.
I almost want to argue with you about who knows best, because I might say that researchers know best, but I have to say I'm in this luxurious position. The project is nearly 25 years old. It will turn so next year. And we just cannot stop encountering what are the benefits of this project. When it was started, yeah, People talked about it as if it were a living legacy, because you were talking to living veterans. But now we know like you say, with these hundreds of thousands of collections and this corpus, this body that people can interact with every day through the website, come to our reading room at the Library of Congress, it is already contributing to hundreds of books. It's contributing to studies of mental health and medical health. It's contributing to choreography. So, yes, it is a huge benefit.
It really is a part of the historical record. I mean, so much has been written and documented from a historical standpoint on virtually every global conflict, but this really adds something to the historical record that you just don't get elsewhere.
It truly does enliven it. It enriches it. When you're looking at a historical record, typically you're hearing it from a historian's point of view, the military's point of view. It's often top down. This is every participant. So whether it's combat, whether it's logistics, whether it's in the kitchen, whether it's sitting in a computer bank in Nevada for a current conflict issue, all of these moments that these individuals are having, we're seeing the unmediated hearing, the raw of their experience as they witness history and connect us to it.
So, again, there's this emphasis to really add more stories to the collection as we get into the holiday season, as we were saying. How do veterans and volunteers who would like to participate get involved, and who is eligible, I guess, or who are you looking for in particular to submit their history to this project?
Everyone can participate, 16 and older, by doing this voluntary act of service. It's not volunteer with a title and quotes around it. You can do it. We're recruiting the stories of U.S. veterans who served from World War I through the more recent conflict. So that could be working with your family to gather the letters and photographs that are in the hall closet of a World War I family member. It can be going out the door and talking to someone you've never considered might be a veteran before and asking them about their service and whether they've served, and then asking to conduct an interview with them. It is really as simple as using that recording device in your pocket, going to our website, talking to people, and making it happen. So World War I to current conflict veterans, those are the stories we're recruiting, but anyone 16 and above is a witness to history and then becomes part of history by participating in the project.
And then, as you mentioned, all of this is available through the Library of Congress. If you can't go to the library itself and see the firsthand, you also have these stories online, right?
120,000 plus records of individual first person experience. Over 70% of those records contain some digitized material that lets you get to the heart of the matter, hear and see directly from those veterans, and growing, I might add. We're constantly digitizing, constantly adding to these collections. So you have a direct conduit to hear directly from the veteran for what she saw. What was it like for her? How did he feel when he was trying to connect with family members, from somewhere in Vietnam? Did he do it with an audio recording? Did he do it with a letter? You're hearing directly from them through the website, loc.gov/vet.
I think it is just a tremendous project. Encourage everyone to get involved because, again, these are the real life stories that really need to be preserved for so many reasons. Monica Mahindra, again, director of the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, with us this morning. Monica, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
We appreciate the spotlight. Thank you.
Your Football Friday forecast, still really good for this time of year. You know, week number 12 of the high school football season, to have temperatures in the upper 40s and low 50s, that's not bad. We will take that. Right about 52 at kickoff tonight, down around 50 at halftime, and into the upper 40s at the end of the evening, and clear skies should be perfect football weather. With the Trojans having been eliminated from the high school football playoffs, we turn our attention this week to Hancock County's other schools in Division 5, Region 18. Liberty Benton will travel to Liberty Center right here on WFIN. While in D7, Region 26, Macomb, coming off last week's win over Eden, next travels to Mohawk for a regional quarterfinal matchup on our sister station, 100.5 WKXA. And earlier this week, Panthers head coach Chris Algie sat down with John Marshall on the Coach's Corner.
10 games are the standard each season, though, as is often the case, your Panthers get the opportunity to play more than 10 this year.
Yeah, we're excited about that. And, you know, we played Eden the last 2 years before this year, and they had to travel to our place. And I'll tell you what, it's not a... It's definitely not a short trip, and about an hour and 40-minute bus ride, and it was nice to be able to go there, and because they're a good football team. I mean, Bob's done a great job there. They were 9-1, and our kids played lights out.
With that win, you advanced to the regional quarterfinal this week. You again take a little trip, this one a little closer as you visit Mohawk. That's only really about 35 miles rather than 60-odd that you had to do last week. Does that make a difference, or is it just a matter of, hey, we'll go and play because it's week 12 and we get to play, so hooray for us?
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's the latter you mentioned. We scrimmaged them this year, actually the last 2 years, and we had to travel to Mohawk this year back in August. So we made that trip already. We know the field. But when you get to week 12, you don't really care where you're playing.
Mohawk, 9-2 overall, finishing the regular season as champions of the Northern 10 at 6-1. In large part, it's the Ben Bogner show. Their senior quarterback, 6'5", 6 foot, 185. He's run for over 1,100 yards this year, but he's not one-dimensional. He can throw. He's done so for almost 2,000 yards, connecting with number 5, Kane Heyman, 52 times for over 900 yards. Caleb Bish, the number 2 player there, 31 times for 600 yards. That's a potent offensive attack. I'm not sure that you've seen any one player who is so much the focus of the offense of any of the teams you played this year. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, for the most part, I guess I would consider maybe the green kid from Ada, who was he was a beast at quarterback, and you know, had rushed for 1,200 yards and also threw for about over 1,000 some. But he does it all for them, and we call them the three-headed monsters with him. The Heyman kid and Bish kid are athletes. They're all about 6 foot, 6'1", 185 pounds, and they can fly. And they just do a really good job of blocking and running, double tight formations and spread looks. But he can throw it too. And the thing he does really well is he's able to get out of pressure, scramble, and then find one of those receivers, come back to the ball, and they make a play. And our defense has its hands full this week.
It doesn't get any easier on the other side of the ball either. The Mohawk defense, the best in the Northern 10, giving up just 11 points a game. Your offense has some work cut out for them.
Yeah, we definitely do. They're very similar to us. What we do on offense, they do on offense. And defense, different. They run a 3-2, 5-2 look, and we're a 4-3 team. But, we're definitely going to have to move the chains, get first downs like we did against Eden, and try to keep, their offense off the field.
As far as the roster size-wise, you seem to match up pretty well.
Yeah, they've got two big dudes that match up with Madden and Elijah Gibbs with us. And, they're senior, junior, dominated. We're sort of senior juniors, and they've got a couple, freshmen or sophomores, similar. Like I said, if you look at them and us, we're very similar on paper, and it's going to be fun to see, how we've improved and how they've improved from our scrimmage in August, and now we get a chance to play them in week 12. But I'm happy for our kids, coming away with a win, and we had kids step up. Cam Smith made some great catches against Eden. He was a sophomore playing JV, got a chance to play. We had, Brody Gallagher came in at outside linebackers, a sophomore. We had a freshman, Jackson Duran, stepped up at defensive end for us. And then, Elijah Gibbs and Grady Schrader and Braden Shoup and the kids just came to play. So we're excited to see what we do this week.
Again, that Division 7 Region 26 showdown between Macomb and Mohawk can be heard tonight on our sister station, 100.5 WKXA, and online at WKXA.com. We will have the Liberty Benton Liberty Center game in Division 5 Region 18 right here on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM. Meanwhile, over on 106.3 The Fox tonight, Ottawa Glandorf travels to Shelby for a regional quarterfinal action. That also on 1063thefox.com. And of course, you can follow along with all of the action tonight, the WFIN scoreboard page, powered by ScoreStream and presented by Owens Community College. That's at WFIN.com/scoreboard. We also have a link at our webpage at goodmornings.net.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Sometimes you don't have to go very far to find the broken news. In Toledo, a drunk driver is in custody after crashing into the back end of a police cruiser. Way to be subtle there. That's the incident happened just before 3 a.m. on Thursday morning when a minivan crashed into a cruiser on Star Avenue. The cruiser was sitting there with its lights on. It was stopped. Police say two police officers were inside the cruiser. Neither were injured in the crash, nor was the driver of the minivan. I would imagine that the reason he or she, it doesn't say, was drinking was because they were probably despondent over driving a minivan. Be my thought. The driver taken into custody on charges of DUI. So. Crashed into the back of a police cruiser. Not just causing a crash, but smashing the back end of a police cruiser with its lights on. Wow. Elsewhere in the broken news, you know, it is getting to be that time of year. And skating rinks are opening around the country. And in the UK, a skating rink worker accidentally froze his daughter's phone in the ice. And now it can't be recovered until 2025. They will not melt the rink in order to retrieve this guy's daughter's phone. The worker left his daughter's bright pink phone on the side of the rink, the Milton Keynes rink, and 15,850 gallons of water was then poured into the venue. By the time the phone was discovered, it was encased in ice, and they were like, nope, we're not melting the rink in order to retrieve the phone, so it'll just have to stay there. If we were to dig it out, it would affect the structure of the ice, so it will remain encased for the next 2 months. According to ICE Leisure Director Rob Cook, the anonymous worker promised his daughter a new phone if this one does not work when it's recovered. But what is she supposed to do in the meantime? Okay, that's great. Thanks, Dad. You're going to buy me a new phone when we get the old one back and if it doesn't work. But what do I do in the meantime? Just go ahead and buy your daughter a new phone now. It's not going to work after being encased in ice for 2 months, covered with 15,000 gallons of water. Forget about it. Let's see. Speaking of seasonal fun, police in Utah say that they found a rather unusual gift wrapped in Christmas paper at a traffic stop recently. Utah Highway Patrol troopers say they pulled over a Dodge Charger traveling at over 110 miles an hour on I-15. When a canine officer was brought to the scene, the animal led the police to a couple of Christmas presents. Well, they were wrapped like Christmas presents. Turns out they were safes that were wrapped up like Christmas presents, and the safes contain vacuum-sealed containers with various drugs and drug paraphernalia. Well, Merry Christmas! Troopers arrested Klaus Alexander Gellender and Robert Earl Robinson on three counts of suspicion of drug possession with intent to distribute and numerous other charges. They knew that they had the intent to distribute because they were wrapped as Christmas presents. They were going to give away. You can't really claim that you weren't going to give them away or that you weren't going to distribute them if you wrap them up like Christmas gifts. Yeah. Let's see. A couple of other items here in today's Broken News Report. A hotel in the Philippines has just been named the largest building in the shape of a chicken. Now, we shouldn't laugh about that too much. I mean, Ohio, obviously, you know that we hold the distinction of the largest building shaped like a picnic basket there in Columbus, you know, the old Longaberger basket building. That's still there, even though the company isn't. But the largest building in the shape of a chicken, this hotel in the Philippines, Ricardo Guapo said he wanted his resort's new building to be an attention grabber. And it certainly has been that. As to why a rooster, Ricardo says, quote, our country has a game fowl industry that employs millions of people in the Philippines. And if you look at a rooster, it looks calm and commanding, imposing and strong, which reflects the attitude of our people. Largest building in the shape of a chicken. Why do I suddenly want to visit the Philippines? I want to go see this place. I got to see it with my own two eyes. Got to stay there. I'm going to put that on my bucket list. Imagine the excitement of a kindergartner by the name of River Vandenberg. She's a kindergartner, found a bottle on the shores of Lake St. Clair in Ontario. And then imagine his surprise at discovering it had a connection to one of his classmates. Turns out the bottle was tossed in Lake St. Clair in 1998 by Mackenzie Van Eyck, who, along with the rest of her fourth grade class, was asked to write a letter about the Great Lakes, put it in a bottle, and throw it into the water. Now, River happens to go to St. John the Baptist Catholic Elementary School in Bell River, Ontario, and is in the fourth grade with Mackenzie's daughter, Scarlett. River's grandmother sent the message along to Scarlett's teacher, who read the note to her class, waiting until the very end to reveal the name of the author. And Scarlett said, "My mouth completely dropped when I realized that was my mom that wrote the letter in the bottle that her classmate River actually found." Ms. Van Eyck, who always wondered what happened to the note she wrote, said it was pretty memorable to do something like that, throw something into the river, lake, and think maybe someone will find it later. So now she knows the fate of her message in a bottle. That is actually really cool. That is really cool. And finally, in the broken news this morning, I know Veterans Day is coming up next week, but that is not the biggest celebration that is happening next week. It is, in the state of Oregon, Exploding Whale Day next Tuesday. I kid you not, it is an official state holiday, Exploding Whale Day. Here's the story. 44 years ago, the carcass of a deceased whale washed ashore on a beach in Florence, Oregon. Because it was too large to be removed whole, it was exploded by a demolition team using a half ton of dynamite. They brought it in. They figured it'd be easier to clean up the remains rather than try to remove the carcass whole. It was so big. Apparently, a lot of people showed up to see this spectacle, and the onlookers were covered in the remnants of the exploding whale. And now, that fateful day has become an official state holiday. November 12th has officially been declared Exploding Whale Day. But that's not all. At the Exploding Whale Memorial Park, they are actually celebrating Exploding Whale Month with all kinds of activities for the entire month, but culminating on Tuesday, there was actually even a petition going around to blow up another whale carcass in remembrance of the one more than four decades ago. I don't think they'll be doing that, but the organizer of all of the Exploding Whale Day activities at Exploding Whale Memorial Park, Elaine McMillan, says Oregonians aren't necessarily proud of the event, but we need to maintain a sense of humor about it. We feel that to remember something that went so wrong can make an ongoing positive difference in our small little coastal community. Exploding Whale Day next week in the state of Oregon. Book your tickets now. There you go. You just can't make something like that up. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Ever wonder what being a Findlay Rotarian is all about?
I'm Alyssa Preston, director of the Hancock County Convention and Visitors Bureau. I am proud to be a Findlay Rotarian because locally we make an impact by recognizing amazing educators in the Findlay and Hancock County area through the Golden Apple Award.
To become part of an organization that brings together business, professional leaders to provide community service and advance goodwill, contact Findlay Rotary at findlayrotary.org and click on join.
This message provided by WFIN.
Time now for your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. This is post-election polling from the folks at YouGov, polling experts, and we've been highlighting some of their polling results for the past couple of days after the election. This is actually a couple of different surveys, one of just around 3,000 U.S. adults and the other, I think, a little over 5,000 U.S. adults. They asked, how many of Donald Trump's campaign promises do you think he will be successfully implement? How many of his campaign promises will he successfully implement? 10% said all of them. Another 10% said none of them. 26% said most of them, and 24% said a few of them. So they followed that up with the question, how many of Donald Trump's campaign promises do you think he will attempt to implement? And 21% said all of them, which is kind of interesting. Only 10% think he will successfully implement all of them, but 21% say he will attempt to implement all of them. 9% said none of them. 27% said most of them. 17% said some of them. 12% said a few of them. And this, I thought, was kind of interesting because we were talking about this yesterday in our Throwback Thursday with the author of The First Gentleman, talking about a gender-flipped White House and the fact that it's probably inevitable that at some point we will elect our first woman president. Didn't happen this time. Didn't happen in 2016. But eventually it will happen. And they asked, do you think America is ready to elect a woman president? 41% said yes, 41% said no. An even split right down the middle in the question of whether America is ready to elect a woman president. And by the way, they didn't attach any political affiliation to said woman president. It's just a generic question. 18% say that they are not sure, which I think is that in and of itself is kind of an interesting statement on where we are as a country with respect to this. And they followed that up with a question, do you personally, and again, yesterday we were saying this will probably happen sooner rather than later. Well, it seems that most people do agree with that sentiment. They asked, do you personally hope that the United States elects a woman president in your lifetime? 52% said yes, and 22% said no. Which, again, if you relate to the previous question of whether you think America is ready for a woman president, that was right down the middle. But do you personally hope that we elect a woman president in your lifetime? 52% actually said yes, only 22% said no. 26% were not sure in terms of the answer to that question.
Thank you.
as is customary, to finish up the week, my wife Kyra has joined us in the studio with another collection of recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. And this is kind of an Italian flavor to it.
Sort of an Italian theme, kind of a just a fun, if you don't,
nice warm
alternative
dish.
Alternative to pizza.
Okay.
So it's an alternative to pizza if you don't. If you had enough pizza,
but you need something quick.
Yes. Yeah. This is an alternative.
This only takes what? About a half hour?
Oh, yeah. So, if that. Yeah. So not that long, and it's really good.
All right. So here we go. It is a cheese tortellini and pepperoni casserole.
Yes. So this is one 19-ounce package of frozen cheese tortellini, one tablespoon of olive oil, one medium onion chopped, two cloves of garlic minced, 2.5 cups of marinara sauce, 2 teaspoons of Italian seasoning, 2 cups of shredded mozzarella, 1 cup of sliced pepperoni, 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese, and salt and pepper to taste. So pretty much preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Cook the tortellini according to the package instructions until al dente. Then drain and set aside in a large skillet. Heat the olive oil over medium heat. Add your chopped onion and your minced garlic, and then saute that until the onions become translucent. Stir in your marinara sauce and Italian seasoning. Bring the mixture to a simmer. Then season with the salt and pepper. And then in a large mixing bowl, combine the cooked tortellini and the sauce mixture, tossing that gently. Pour 1/2 of the sauce tortellini mixture into a greased 9x13-inch baking dish. Layer 1/2 of the pepperoni slices. And then if there's any other favorite toppings that you like, you don't just have to use pepperoni. If you like olives on your pizza, if you like banana peppers on your pizza, if you like, sausage. Yes, any of that stuff. Yeah. You can layer it up. So you're going to...
Sausage, bacon.
Yep.
No pineapple, though. No...
If you like it, if you want to try it,
we're not going to go into that.
So
then, over Hawaiian pizza.
Yep. So then do your layers, then 1 cup of your mozzarella cheese. Repeat the layers remaining with the tortellini, the pepperoni, any of your favorite toppings.
So you're layering that like a lasagna.
Yep. The top of the casserole with some grated Parmesan cheese. Bake in your preheated oven for 30 minutes until the casserole is bubbly and the cheese is golden. And let it cool just for a little bit and enjoy.
There you go. The cheese tortellini and pepperoni casserole. I can see that would be a good alternative to your standard pizza if you want to do something a little bit different, but still pretty simple.
Yes.
And then, of course, because you've got an Italian dish, you got to have garlic bread. Yeah. This is crescent dough garlic bread.
So this is a very interesting, I like this recipe. 1/4 cup of butter melted, 2 tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese, 1 tablespoon of minced garlic, 1 8-ounce package of refrigerated crescent rolled dough, 1/2 teaspoon of Italian seasoning, 1/2 teaspoon of ground black pepper to your taste, 1/4 teaspoon of paprika. So preheat your oven to 375 degrees. Line a baking sheet with parchment paper. Mix your butter, your Parmesan cheese, and your garlic in a bowl. Open the dough container, but do not unroll it. Cut it into 12 equal pieces using a serrated knife. Place each of those dough pieces onto your prepared baking sheet. Brush with your garlic butter that you just made. Sprinkle each with some Italian seasoning, pepper, and paprika. Bake in your preheated oven until golden brown for 16 to 20 minutes, and then enjoy. You don't even have to unroll it. It's just a really cool recipe.
Easy.
Yeah, now, and so easy.
It is noteworthy that you are doing this at 375. You're doing the casserole at 350. Yeah.
If you can do these at 350.
Just
going to add a little bit of time, which is fine.
Which actually should come out okay, because you're at 375 for like 16 to 20 minutes, 350 on the casserole for a half hour.
Yeah.
May actually work out. Might need to check the garlic bread a little bit
Especially if it's above your casserole. Just
there you go.
Check on it.
All right.
And,
So here you got the one... dish meal there.
Yes.
With the cheese tortellini and pepperoni casserole on the crescent dough garlic bread. And then for dessert,
yes,
we have cake mix peanut butter brownies.
I know. Yum. So just one yellow cake mix, two eggs, a third cup of vegetable oil, half a cup of peanut butter, smooth or chunky, one cup of peanut butter chips or chocolate, and a cup of Reese Pieces. So preheat your oven to 350 degrees using an electric mixer. Mix together the cake mix, the egg, the oil, and the peanut butter. Mix that until it's well combined. Then for the rest of the stuff, then fold in your Reese Pieces and your peanut butter chips or your chocolate chips if you want to. Then pat the batter into a 9 by 9 inch pan or 9 by 13 inch pan if you want your brownies to be thinner. Mm-hmm. So depending on your, however you want your brownies to be, then bake 14 to 17 minutes. Now, if you do the 9 by 9, it may take a little bit longer.
Okay.
I do the 9 by 13, which makes it thinner. So that's
okay, the 14 by 17 is based on the larger pan. Right.
Correct. So if you're doing a little bit thicker, I would say you're probably going to go about 25, 30 minutes or so. But just check it, make sure, until it's golden brown, then cool for 20 minutes and then enjoy like with some ice cream.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something now, like that. Something yummy, yummy.
Real quickly to clarify, when you talk about using the cake mix, you're not going to prepare the cake mix like it says on the box.
You're just using the mix.
When you put all of that in the mixing bowl, it's just the dry cake mix.
Yes.
You're going to use the eggs and the oil and that stuff, but not necessarily
use
the
these measurements.
Okay.
Yeah. Two eggs, a third cup of oil, and then your peanut butter.
Yeah.
Those ingredients are taking the ingredients from your box, sort of, but it's going to be thicker.
Because it's brownie, not a cake. Yes. So just a note there with respect to that. And kind of interesting that you say smooth or chunky peanut butter with, I guess, if you like nuts in your brownies.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that. When I first saw that and it said smooth or chunky, I was like, ew, chunky.
Yeah.
But
We
have nuts in brownies.
So, yes.
Yep. I can see
lots
that.
Lots of people like walnuts or pecans in their brownies.
Yeah.
But this would just be peanuts.
Although I suppose you could use, it's chunky peanut butter. You're going to have peanuts, but anyway, okay. So we've got the cheese tortellini and pepperoni casserole, the crescent dough garlic bread, and the cake mix peanut butter brownie recipes posted at the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page at Kyra's Kitchen WFIN on Facebook, right?
Yep.
You can also, find more of the recipes that we've highlighted in the past from Kyra's Kitchen there. That's where you go, because we'll occasionally get somebody who will message us and say, hey, what was that recipe? I didn't catch that recipe. You can go to the Facebook page, and that's where they're all posted.
Yep.
Also, that is linked up at goodmornings.net. And as we always say, if there's something that you are looking for, or if you have a favorite recipe to share, by all means, go to the Facebook page and share it.
Yes.
Or you can also email us goodmornings@wfin.com for those recipes if you would like to share. Because always looking for yummy new recipes.
Yeah, Thanksgiving's coming up, and that's the one I'm working on right now.
Okay, all right. So if you have a favorite, everybody has a favorite family recipe for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
What is yours?
It needs to be easy. I mean, I can't do all this crazy stuff. I'm an easy person, I mean, there are some of these recipes I see, and they're so complex, and I'm like, wow. I'm feeding around 30 people. I need simple.
So get those into us. Yes. Again, my wife Kyra with more recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Once again, remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. That is goodmornings.net. Coming up Monday on the program, if you've been paying attention, the western U.S. is already getting their first big snowstorm of the season. How long before the wintry weather reaches us, and how much of it will we see? We will gaze into the crystal ball of the Old Farmer's Almanac for the answer. So until Monday morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day, a great weekend. We'll catch you back here next week.